Great, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's January 11th, 2017. And as you probably know, last year we spent a lot of time on mindfulness, and we were kind of finishing up in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is kind of a catch-all for a number of important lists in Buddhism, including the seven factors of awakening, which is where we focused. And the last one we were exploring was investigation, which raised the whole question of what are we investigating? And kind of on the heels of that, I said the last time I was here, which was 3 weeks ago, that my planning for 2017, this year, is to build on investigation and in particular explore the world of relationships, because that's where, for most of us, our greatest joys and greatest sorrows come from and play out in. And that's also a territory where there's a lot of useful psychology. My own background in psychology began with developmental psychology. My dissertation was on the desires of 15-month-olds and what happened when they ran up against the desires of their mother in real time with lots of videotaping. That was back in like 1989 or something, where you'd lug a video camera around. It was incredibly heavy. And I bribed the participants in my study to let me come into their homes by giving them a videotape, back when there were videotapes, and they were fairly rare, of them interacting with their children. Of course, after the study, I'm not sure how many of them burned the videotape quickly because they didn't want to see what was necessarily on it. I had to make a batch of cookies with their kid and see what would happen and so forth. Anyway, so I have a background in developmental psychology and psychology generally, and there's a lot of good stuff there that intersects with Buddha Dharma, I think, in many useful, insightful, practical ways. So I kind of hope to explore that this year. And including with that, do probably one time roughly a month with full warning that's a little more experiential, where instead of the classic format that many people, including us, have used for a long time of sort of presentation discussion, to do things that are more experiential after people come back from the break. And I'll communicate about that in an email that will go out to everybody in the sitting group. And if you don't get emails from me about the sitting group and you want to, I need your email address over there. You may already get stuff from me like my Just One Thing newsletter, but if you're not on the sitting group email list, I won't send you things particular to this group. So if you want to get them, I need your email address. Okay. So I'll let you know all about that. I'll warn you about all that. You can always sit it out and so forth. But that's kind of the plan for the year. So that's what we talked about previously. For tonight, partly because I've had a flu and partly because I think for a lot of people these days, a lot of things are on their minds. Entry into the new year, implications of the recent presidential and other elections, world events, rain, you know, old age, disease, and death. A few things. So I thought tonight, honestly, and partly too, it'll help me get a feeling for you. You just kind of open it up for questions, discussion, kind of loose. So I don't have a prepared talk. You're welcome, by the way. No, I don't have a prepared talk tonight. It's okay. And I thought we'd just kind of kick it around. What's on your mind? And, you know, what questions might you have about Buddhism, about the Dharma, or about how that perspective, because that's kind of the setting here, what we're up to here, how that perspective and how that wisdom stream, 2,500 years old, might be of use to you in some way. Any questions, comments? Yeah, please.
I do.
Great.
My name's Leslie.
Thank you.
I just got Hardwiring Happiness, and I'm really excited about it.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you.
I would like to know, how does the neuroplasticity and the willful neuroplasticity cross over with Buddhism?
That is such a great question, I think, because, you know, it's when I bump into. So I'll say it also for the recording and maybe for others. How does this idea of willful neuroplasticity, or what Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA called self-directed neuroplasticity, what does that have to do, or how does that relate with Buddhism? Right? So first, there are many Buddhisms. The tradition I'm most trained in and kind of is where we're centered here is, in a sense, the early original trunk of the Buddha Dharma, early northern Indian Buddhism, sometimes called Theravadan Buddhism as it spread into Southeast Asia, sometimes kind of as a misnomer, but it's current Vipassana-style Buddhism, which basically just means insight, which is present in all branches of Buddhism. It's kind of the earliest surviving written record of the teachings of the Buddha, our best guess as to what he thought and taught and practiced. So that's kind of the Buddhism in which I'll speak, but I think what I'm going to say is relevant to other forms of Buddhism as well. So in Buddhism, there is, as I think you will see in any form of skillful engagement of the mind, three fundamental modes of practice. Just three. Be with what's there, let it be. Experience the experience, feel the feelings, open to it, allow it, maybe investigate it, maybe sense down to what's deeper, perhaps younger, more vulnerable. It may change in the process, but you're not trying to nudge it deliberately. That's one of the great forms of practice. I think it's the most fundamental of the three. It's where we often go as our last resort, and as practice matures, that's more and more what you hear people doing who are really far along in their practice. Okay, be with what's there. Just be with it. Bear the experience. The sweet as well as the bitter. All of it. But that's not enough. That's not all the Buddha taught. That's not all that makes sense, particularly when you take into account the body in a real sense. I mean, lots of people who talk about mindfulness of the body don't really want to pursue the implications of being fundamentally body full of mind. Having a mind that emerges from, is constrained by, conditioned and constructed by this flesh. So that flesh, particularly in terms of the nervous system, especially the brain, is physical. And it tends to hold on to its learning, especially negative learning. So if we want to shift out of habits that lead to suffering and harm for ourselves and other people, often just witnessing the stream of consciousness is not enough. Similarly, if we want to cultivate the wholesome, compassion, loving kindness, intention, tranquility, factors of awakening that we investigated, like tranquility or equanimity or joy, bliss, if we want to have those arise, we also, they don't just grow on their own. We need to do things. We can't just be with the mind. We need to work with it as well. And if you look at the Buddha's teachings, particularly the methods he offered to people, a lot of them fall in the category of working with the mind, cultivating wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, and so forth. So that takes us into two modes of working with the mind, which are summarized under the heading of wise effort, basically letting go of what's painful, problematic, unwholesome, unskillful, and wise, releasing the negative, relaxing tension from the body, for example, venting painful feelings, abandoning unwholesome desires, challenging thoughts that make you crazy, right? Letting go. And then the third great way to practice is to let in, is to cultivate and to grow the wholesome, to develop loving kindness, compassion, virtue, wisdom, and concentration, for example. The three great pillars of Buddhist practice, virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, so we have these great three. Now, some people have taken Buddhist practice to be only the passive witnessing of the stream of consciousness. That's a mistake, I think. I would say that teachers I respect who are deeply steeped in meditation and the profound power of just being with the stream of consciousness. People like Joseph Goldstein and others would fully agree with this view. I have them on videotape because I've interviewed them and it's freely posted and you can find it. Where they say, of course, we need to do more than just witness the stream of consciousness. So there's been, I think, an overvaluing of a passive, receptive stance. There's a place for it, but it's not the entirety of practice. Why not use all the tools in the toolbox skillfully? There are pitfalls with getting too active and effortful with the mind, you know, like you stress about it or, you know, compare this moment to the last moment. Okay. On the other hand, There are pitfalls with the passive stance. If you're not ready to open to your experience, if you haven't grown resources inside, it can be like opening a trap door to hell. You're not ready for that, right? Also, I've known a lot of people. They're really good at meditating. They're really good at watching the mind go by, and they're total assholes. No, that's an overstatement. I'm disinhibited because I'm a little sick. So anyway, but you know, like you just know it. They're like they're not happy. Their heart's not that loving, and you know, their learning curve's pretty flat. You know, I think that practice, in a sense, is like a three-legged stool, and to use the words in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, and I think there are close approximations in Sanskrit. It's a stool of metta, sati, and bhavana, loving kindness, mindfulness, and cultivation. And there are a lot of people who are trying to practice with just a one-legged stool. They've got really good mindfulness, but their heart's not very open or warm. And there's not much of a learning curve, cultivation, learning, healing, development, growth over time. So it's the whole of the practice. It's the whole of the path that we engage. And so for me, that is a way of looking at then the potential that's present in what scientists call experience-dependent neuroplasticity. This idea that our nervous system is designed to be changed by the experiences flowing through it, for better or worse. And because of the brain's negativity bias, we're very vulnerable to overlearning from our negative experiences, painful, stressful experiences, and we're not very good at learning from, cultivating from, healing from, growing from our beneficial experiences. So, in my view, in the frame of metta, sati, and bhavana, loving kindness, mindfulness, and cultivation, in that frame, there's a real place for deliberate cultivation. I think of the three legs of that stool, generally, that's the leg of the stool. Deliberate cultivation, deliberate helping yourself grow from the experiences you're actually having in life, that's where the greatest opportunity is for many, many people. They're already pretty solid on their mindfulness, their heart's warm, they have good intentions, they're not yet a saint, but they're, you know, good people, good-hearted. But there are plenty of upside opportunities to steepen their personal growth curve as they go through the day, the week, and the lifespan. And that's become, therefore, a particular focus of mine, the process of how do you take in the good? How do you really skillfully engage the fundamentally two-stage process of learning? That's how growth happens. That's how healing happens. That's how we become wiser, more loving, more peaceful. First, we have to have an experience of what we want to grow inside ourselves. We have to start with getting that song playing in our mind of the beneficial experience, you know, or resource we want to develop. But it's not enough to just play the song in your mind, to just have the experience. That's a beneficial state. But to turn it into a beneficial trait, we have to turn on the recorder inside. We have to help that transient pattern of mental neural activation become a lasting change in the nervous system, a lasting change of neural structure or function. Otherwise, no learning by definition. No healing, no growth, no lasting value. You might enjoy state-to-state-to-state processes, even spirals, but if those get interrupted, boop, suddenly you feel like you're running on empty inside. If you haven't already grown resources, if you haven't been turning those states into some kind of beneficial trait. That gives us tremendous opportunities to use our wholesome beneficial experiences. Moments of calming, moments of connecting, a beautiful flower, a sense of grit, determination, what it feels like to pull your mind out of resentment, pull it out of those looping cases about other people, what it feels like to step out of, as President Obama said last night, arguing with strangers on Facebook. You know, what that feels like as an opportunity to grow a strength inside. And then, in valuing it, we help ourselves for 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row to keep those neurons firing, as it were, so they keep on wiring as well. And that's wonderfully hopeful. It means that every day is full of opportunities for growth and learning. It's also very responsibility focusing, because it's on us to do that. It's on us to turn on the recorder and help those little experiences really, really, really sink in, which for me comes from not a chasing of pleasures, not from a California pie in the sky, rose-colored glasses, look on the bright side kind of take. No, it comes from a hard-headed recognition that life is often difficult. And for some people, it's always difficult. And we need to have resources inside ourselves to meet those challenges of life and have things inside that we can offer to other people as well. And a hard-headed recognition of the brain's negativity bias, making it like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. And so coming from that place then, we can get on our own side. You know, we can use every day as a phenomenal opportunity to develop. And at the end of the day, know that we learned as much as we could. Thank you. What do you make of all that? Or anything else? How about those Golden State Warriors? Anyway. Yeah, sure.
Moving into more confusion and questions. Last week we talked about awareness and investigation.
Right. And the difference between the two.
Yes, the difference between the two. That one's still juggling, growing, going down the river and being a river. And the question also comes up in my mind, where's the unconscious, subconscious mind in that?
Okay, so last time we were here, I think about 3 weeks ago, right? You asked the question, we were talking about investigation, and what's the difference between awareness and investigation? So let's make it real right now. Okay, little experiential moment here.
Yes.
So you're aware, right? Because you're awake and alert. You are conscious. Okay? So there is awareness. And also, right now, appearing in awareness are lots of things. Sensations, sounds, meanings, little reveries, lots of stuff bubbling around. I think of the awareness as sort of like the surface of a cup of soda water. And the various little bubbles fizzing away are different elements of experience happening quite quickly. So we have a field, and we have content in the field. You could think of it as the screen of the television, and then all the patterns moving through those pixels. Right? And that's very direct. That's right in our experience. So far, so okay? Now, how we experience, you know, or why is red red, right? Why does it feel like it feels when you sit in a chair? Why does cinnamon smell like cinnamon? No scientist knows the answer to that question. There's some good guesses. I personally think we're a century away from a final solution to the so-called hard problem in consciousness, because it's a hard problem. But clearly there's a correlation between the experiences we're having and the underlying material, physical, biological processes going on in the body, especially in the brain. Okay, so far? Okay. So we don't need to know exactly how we experience the color red to get that, okay, kind of bringing it down, there is awareness, and there's stuff in awareness. Often we'll have an experience where there's a lot of awareness, often in meditation. You just boom, there's not much stuff in it. Maybe even to the point of extreme states of absorption where there's just almost nothing there. Maybe a little bit of peacefulness, but otherwise, it's really quiet. Or maybe you first wake up, right? Kind of awareness, and there is awareness. There's a sense of being there, but there's not yet much content. And then you suddenly realize, you know, oh, I gotta get my tooth pulled today. Or you realize, oh, there's a party tonight or something, you know. But before that happens, there's mostly just awareness. Okay. Investigation is active. So let's try it right now. So you might, let me think for a moment here. Think of a recent situation that bothered you a little bit. Sorry. It's okay? I don't mean to freak you out. A little bit. Like really, really small. Okay? Really, really small. Okay? Just with another person, maybe? That's an easy one. Okay? And then, without, you know, again, flooding yourself with trauma or anything like that, look into it. You know, ask yourself, what bothered me about that situation? Or you might investigate, what were some of the body sensations you were having in the experience of feeling bothered? Right? What's investigating like? How's it different from just awareness? So maybe some thinking, some directed application. It may not be verbal thinking, but it's right applied. Yeah.
Feeling.
You're feeling into it. That's how I talk about feeling down into it.
It's internal.
There's an internal, you're coming into your own experience.
Curiosity
guiding you. Yeah. Maybe a in therapy they'll talk about an uncovering.
Oppression.
What?
Oh,
yeah, sometimes you don't, but you can sometimes take the lid off. And here's another investigation that's very central to Buddhism, where you don't so much investigate content, but you investigate the nature of experience. So let's just do it right now for a dozen or two dozen seconds. Sustain an awareness as best you can, and kind of be curious about the quality of experience is constantly changing. Wow. Can you see that? You're kind of, you know, it's no more than it is. It's not a big deal or mystical. You're just looking into it. You know, there might be a sense of a kind of fresh knowing. Like, wow, it really is changing. You know, I heard nattering away, impermanent, impermanent, impermanent. But like, whoa, it's not stable whatsoever. Wow. That's a kind of investigating. And in Buddhism, there's an emphasis on investigating the nature of experience and observing more and more its sort of fizzing, insubstantial, granular, compounded, transient, ownerless, directorless, scriptwriterless qualities. And in so doing, become disenchanted about craving and clinging. Through insight, vipassana, again and again, into the nature of experience, which is fueled by, you know, enabled by investigation.
Now I don't have to read the book.
Yeah, well. other comments, questions? Great.
So when you were talking about neuroplasticity, on her comment, like, when you do have a negative experience and you've moved through it, and you maybe have you've just moved through it, and say you help someone else who's going through a similar experience, does that help you to retrain your neuroplasticity around your experience?
You mean helping other people?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. So if I got you right, if we're helping other people, let's say, with sort of similar issues maybe, does that help us? I think it really can. In other words, from the standpoint of neuroplasticity, if your mind is changing, your brain has to be changing as well. Otherwise, we're left with magic. Now, I believe in magic, okay? I think there is supernatural, transcendental stuff, but on the whole, you know, evidence of mental change is evidence of neural change. Okay, so if it's working for you, something good is changing in your body, particularly little, dinky little quick things inside your own brain. Okay, now, when you're helping another person, it really is true. We often realize things and learn things helping others. I remember being in grad school reading Abnormal Psychology, like that literally was the name of the required course to be a licensed psychologist. Abnormal is the term. The point is, as I was reading through all this deep, dark stuff, I was learning a lot about my own basement, you know, my own stuff. And so by learning about others, we can learn about ourselves in all kinds of ways, including learning about others who are exemplars of what we want to grow into ourselves. We can kind of get a feeling of channeling them, of opening to them. And that actually goes to a kind of investigation that people don't often talk about, but in a funny way I think is actually really powerful. It's less that we, drill into our own experience, like send down like one of those Roto-Rooter things with a camera on it. You know, I mean, there's a place for that, but there's also a kind of investigation where we sort of open wide. We go, we allow ourselves to be surprised. I was reading Suzuki Roshi Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, or pieces of it, and he has a famous quotation, which is paraphrased basically, in the beginner's mind are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, only a few. And there's something about just opening to that child mind, beginner mind, fresh mind, don't know mind, novelty, receptive mind, surprise, receptive mind, that can allow new insight to emerge and new understandings to emerge. That too can be a kind of investigation. Not to know everything already there is to know about your own neurosis, right, as it were. I'm using that term applied to myself. But on the other hand, just because we're having that useful experience with that other person, let's say, helping them, having an insight into ourselves, maybe that's only half of the two-stage process of learning. The other half is installation, where we help that insight, that empathy, that opening in our body, or even the channeling, quote unquote, of that other person who's exemplary in some way, that we want to really help it land. That phase, installation, is a necessary condition of learning, right? Without it, there's no lasting change. So if you're having those openings, what I do, and I think it's what people do, and we can do it more consciously, is to slow it down, flag it, recognize that it's a keeper, with or without internal language about that. Recognize it's a keeper, appreciate it, honor it, and kind of like have the humility of receptivity to realize, oh, this would really serve me. I don't already have all the answers. I'm not already cooler than sliced bread. It would really be good to take this in, and probably it would help me be less of a jerk with other people. Like, whoa. You know, I don't mean that to whip on yourself, but you know what I mean? A certain humility, a kind of recognition that we practice for the sake of other people as well. And out of a kind of benevolence for them, we want to help ourselves have as steep as possible learning curve. Great.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about sort of the balance, or at least what I would perceive as a balancing act between being effectively, constructively on your own side and not getting too attached to outcomes in ways that torpedo you.
Yeah, that beautiful. So to say it again, how do we balance being for ourselves, leaning into the future on our own side without getting attached to what happens? That's something I have really had a lot of interest in, because diversity, again, you know, I am determined to a fault. I'm, you know, I want to get the result. And so you got to watch it, right? So how do you do that? How do you internalize the wisdom of non-attachment while raising children that you're very attached to? Or rock climbing, where you're really attached, so holding on to that little edge. It's like, speak from some experience, right? How do you balance that? Is that, that's where you're getting at, right?
Yes.
I think it's deeply important, especially for people that are engaged in the world. The opportunities for attachment as a monastic that is utterly renunciate, they're much more limited. But as worldly beings who are engaging sensual pleasures of various kinds, politically engaged, trying to, you know, committed to social justice, let's say, trying to get a business off the ground, try to get a book published, try to help our kid, you know, learn to read or get into college, you know, like, where, how do you do that without attaching to it, right? Yeah. I think there's a lot that could be said about it to maybe bring it down to a couple things. First thing is, if you look for little opportunities over the course of your day to fuel yourselves, little pit stops, little oases, you know, in the flow of the day, if your tanks are already nearly topped up, it's not so upsetting if you miss a fill-up, in a sense. You follow, you know, in other words, if we're already filled up, if we already feel that our needs are on the whole being met, especially in the core of our being, our needs in psychology, three great needs, safety, satisfaction, and connection, loosely related to the reptilian brainstem, mammalian subcortex, and primate human cortex stages of evolution. So I say, pet the lizard, feed the mouse, hug the monkey, in effect, through repeated experiences of feeling our core needs are met and taking them in. That's the second stage of learning, really internalizing those experiences. Then it's much easier for us to be not so attached if we don't get what we want, or if our efforts are not successful, right? Because we already feel full. So that's my first suggestion. You know, it's a process of engaging the next moment, feeling already safe in your core, already contented, or there's an enoughness in your core, and already connected, already loved and loving. It'd be nice to have more, but there's already a lot. It's like that's where we come from into the next moment. Because if we do, then I'm kind of operationalizing the third noble truth in Buddhism right there, where there's no basis for craving. We might auto-crave out of habit, right? But there's not an underlying neuropsychological basis for the craving. We're not so driven. And therefore, it's a lot easier to enter the next moment without getting so attached to what's happening in it or clinging to the good that's already present. This is a very deep, fundamental point. And in a weird way, it's really good news, because it means that the deliberate cultivation, the deliberate internalization, the deliberate having and internalizing of experiences of needs met, wholesome experiences of needs met, in the flow of everyday life builds up a core inside of unconditional well-being and resilience. It's not so dependent upon conditions outside us. We have it with us wherever we go. Very beautiful, isn't it, to relate to it like that? So that's one thing. Second thing is with regard to this business of making efforts, I call it aspiration without attachment. Know in your heart you've done everything you could. That's the steel, that behind the velvet. If the velvet in the glove, as it were, is to feel already full, already filled up, as much as you can, based on internalization again and again of experiences, the steel is to know you tried your darndest.
That's where I tend to sort of fall down, because in my mind, you always could have done more.
Aha, yeah. You always could have done more, right? Well, that's where I think, in a weird kind of way, we can apply the deep teaching in Buddhism that the deep taproot of suffering is ignorance or delusion. And to reframe that as a form of delusion. Because the truth is often, we really couldn't have done more. I don't mean that in the sense of the kind of weird, for me, New Age pass that, you know, various, that you could give. You say, well, they did the best they could. Well, I don't think Genghis Khan did the best he could, whatever. You know, and you could fill in the blank with other people throughout history, known and not so well known. But the point is, often, you know in your heart, you can have what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. He said there are four sources of happiness in this every ordinary life. One is, this speaks to the point here, and you can think he's writing in a, or communicating 2,500 years ago in a kind of feudal, agrarian, pre-literate culture, essentially. And he says, you know, one is the pleasure in what of developing things in your life lawfully and honorably, of various kinds, possessions, capabilities. Just they're there, and they're there in your life, and you appreciate them. Your relationships, your friends, the food that sits in your refrigerator. That's one source. Second source, the enjoyment of them, right? And then the third primary source, he called it the bliss of blamelessness. That you know in your heart, you've lived by your code, you've operated with integrity, you worked a full day, you did what you could, and you can be at peace about it. You've tended to the causes. You've watered your fruit tree as much as you can. It's honorable. And I think right there, probably, if I could be personal, maybe for you, you could explore establishing for yourself, maybe kind of, you know, imagining a really wise, benevolent being looking at your life and going, this is all you need to do every day. Do that. That's the steal. But when you do that, no fault. No blame. You did what you could. I think that's the second. And then the last one I'll just offer, and I want to make room for one more, and then we'll wrap up. This business about attachment to the results, that, you know, that's where I think a certain wisdom can come in, where through perspective, we realize, you know, so many things affect the outcome. The very first book I wrote was called Mother Nurture. It's about the long-term care and welfare, well-being, mind-body relationships of women raising children, which usually involves, of course, their relationship with their partner. So that was my first book. I really wanted it to be successful. I put a lot of thought into it. I developed these cool ideas, depleted mother syndrome. It was well referenced. It was about the mind, the body, and relationships. We did it with Penguin, a nice prestigious publisher. We really got it going, right? So I definitely watered that fruit tree. The book comes out 6 months after 9/11. Moms, as a market in general, are not terribly interested in their own well-being. Very interested in the well-being of their kids, maybe their relationship, not so much themselves. I'm not a physician, I'm not a woman, and I'm not a professor. 0 for 3. And the book went nowhere. Right? And you realize and it's really a good book. It's solid, it's still, you can get it digitally, the rights reverted, it's available digitally, and you can find it in print. It's a legitimately good book, I think, but psht, out of my hands. You know, and that's not to lay yourself off the hook around doing what you can and the bliss of blamelessness, but it's to realize so many factors are in play, so many causes upstream determine outcome, first of all. And then second, even if you do get that success, how great does it feel 10 minutes later or 10 days later, 10 weeks later, right? And you start becoming kind of disenchanted. You honor the fruit tree, you water the fruit tree, but you start looking at those apples and go, apples, you know, they're nice, they're great, but you don't want to overvalue them. A little detail, maybe I'll, okay, I'm going to stop there. Well, I'll tell you the detail. I noticed it. You can see it yourself. Yeah, I got you hanging there. Sorry. Well, if you're imagining like a reward or imagining a penalty, either one, right? And you're just kind of anticipating it. One thing that has really struck me is how the anticipated reward is usually sweeter in the simulator than it actually is when you actually have dinner with those people or, you know, your book is published or something like that. It's usually not so great. Similarly, the disasters you imagine, like how horrible it would be if you're revealed in that way or that person doesn't call you back or something like that happens, it's like, well, it was unpleasant, but it didn't blow me away. And I think that's because the generator of the inner simulator, you know, these ancient 200 or so million year old subcortical circuits that are very primitive, and they really motivate those little critters back in the day to chase that carrot or run from that stick, you know, because they just think it would be, you know, much sweeter than it actually is or much more horrible usually than it actually was. And you can watch that inner ad agency tricking you. Delusion, again, ignorance again, routinely. And that can help serve that sort of disenchantment.
Thank you.
Okay. All righty, we should wrap up. Sorry, is that okay? Otherwise, I've gone late lately. How about we sit for a minute, all right? And if you like, you might just want to kind of marinate in, as I'm doing, that sense of community, common ground. Okay. Be well. Thank you.